The first aliyah of Parshas Vayishlach is particularly resonant for us at this moment because it is the story of Yaakov preparing for war, or at least the possibility of war, and the Ramban tells us that it has a number of lessons for us. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved Yaakov, the fact that Yaakov didn't rely on his tzidkus and took measures to prepare, and that this will come up in the future, and that we should take lessons from what he did. The Torah tells us that he sent malachim. According to most, this is a reference to people as messengers, but Rashi here says that it's literal malachim, literal angels. The Moshe of Zakenim explains that's because the previous parsha made a reference to angels meeting Yaakov, so perhaps that's the understanding here as well. The Or HaChaim suggests that Yaakov was afraid that Esav wouldn't respect humans, and therefore he had to make an extra statement. Rav Tzadok HaKohen, who among his other accomplishments was described as an angelologist, has quite a lot to say about this and discusses this at great length. So Yaakov sends a message to Esav, and he says that they should tell him, Ko somrun la'adoni la'esav, ko amar avdecha Yaakov, im lavan garti, v'ach v'echar ad'ata. That here I have lived, I have dwelled with Lavan, but this language, garti, Rashi tells us that this is meant to indicate in gematria, tarjag mitzvahs shamarti. Was that a message that he was actually transmitting to Esav? It's a good question, and the Sefer Minchas Machves is a cute vort here, where he points to the fact that the Gemara in Sota tells us that when the language of the Torah is ko, it has to be as it's written, B'lashon HaKodesh, has to be transmitted in Hebrew. It's a halacha that we find in Berachas Kohanim. Ko Sevaruchu has to be done B'lashon HaKodesh. So here too, the language has to be precise, perhaps because of what Rashi is telling us, that there's a gematria being conveyed here. It had to be in the original language. So indeed, was this being conveyed literally to Esav? Perhaps not. Perhaps this is a point he was making for himself in order to remind himself that he had maintained his values, because it's unclear why Esav would be interested in this. Maybe this is a way of Yaakov showing how he maintains his balance. The overall point of im lavan garti, that he was merely living with Lavan as a worker for him, not a actual prince of any kind, but just a ger. So Rashi suggests that that's the message, that he shouldn't create any jealousy with Esav, who already was angry about the brachos, should understand that his life didn't necessarily represent any great wealth. The Chizkuni comments that he wanted to explain that whatever gifts he did have came from Lavan, as opposed to the brachos, and perhaps also that he should understand why it took him until now to reach out, because he was busy with Lavan. This overall mission, the overall purpose of this mission, is a matter of discussion among the Rishonim, what he was trying to accomplish. Rashi and the Chizkuni suggest that he was trying to make peace and to appease Esav. The Radbak, the Radbaz, and the Radak understand that he was acting friendly by talking about what's happening in his past. It's a way of trying to break the ice, so to speak. The Medrash Habir in the Torah Shlema, he lists a number of purposes here, that he wanted to see if Esav had cooled down. He wanted to assess Esav's strength. He wanted to try to defuse his kinna. He wanted to ask permission, and he wanted to flatter him a little bit. He wanted to be machnifin. So this language of Adoni is relevant to that, and the Ramban has a comment that here he was saying Adoni, treating him as if he was a master, respecting the fact that he was his older brother, despite the fact that he had bought the birthright from him. And there's a little bit of a stira in that comment, a little bit of a contradiction, because the suggestion here is that the technical birthright is relevant to the obligation to respect the older brother. In other words, that Yaakov didn't really have to respect Esav anymore because he had bought the birthright from him, and he was only calling him Adoni in order to butter him up, in order to flatter him, but he didn't really have such an obligation anymore because of the birthright sale. And it's a little bit of a contradiction, perhaps, because the Ramban happens to take the position that the obligation of respect to an older brother is a detail of the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, and it's based on the assumption that that's what the father wants. The father wants that the younger siblings should respect the older siblings. And this is in contrast with the view of the Rambam, that the Rambam maintained that the mitzvah of kavod for an older brother is because of the din b'chor, and therefore specifically to an oldest brother. So if the Ramban understands that it's not because of b'chor as opposed to the Rambam, rather, it's because of what the parent would want, so it shouldn't matter that Yaakov bought the birthright. That is only relevant according to the Rambam's formulation, but the Ramban does not base the obligation in the din of Bechor, and in this case, especially, since we know that Yitzchak had preferred Esav, so why would, at least for this purpose, for the purpose of the birthright, so why would this make a difference? Why should there be any relevance to his purchase when the family hierarchy consideration, that's a detail of kibud av v'aim, would have meant that the respect still should be due to Esav anyway? So it's an interesting question to address, and perhaps it can be resolved based on a discussion in the Sefer Esh Tamid of Rav Shlomo Sinneman, where he notes that the obligation of respect that's due to an older brother wasn't really relevant between Yaakov and Esav, because he brings the whole discussion there, he brings the whole proof that it's not really relevant to twins, that the notion of gadol mechavero, that one is actually older than the other, is not something that can be measured by minutes or hours. It's only something that can be measured by days or perhaps by years. But to say that one twin is gadol than the other because they're a few minutes older, that's not relevant terminology for twins. So therefore, the idea of kavod acha gadol is not relevant to Yaakov and Esav. It's just a separate idea that there should be respect for a bechor. So that's what's being reflected here, that even that concept wasn't relevant anymore because Yaakov had bought the birthright from Esav, but he was buttering him up. He was trying to flatter him, and therefore he was referring to him as Adoni, even though he had actually purchased the birthright from him and it was no longer relevant. So in any event, so the messengers come back. The next pasuk tells us v'yashuvu. It's not clear whether they actually gave the message or not. Some say that yes, he did, and the message was accepted. Some say the message wasn't accepted, and some say that they didn't get to give it at all. They saw that Esav was coming to attack, and they turned back. So then the next pasuk tells us that Yaakov was concerned about the fact that Esav is approaching with this big army with 400 men. And the pasuk tells us, "Vayiro Yaakov mo'od vayetzer lo." So Yaakov was very afraid, and he was afraid. First of all, the Gemara comments that why should he be afraid? The Gemara Maseches Brachos on Daf Dalet tells us that his concern was based on the idea that maybe he had lost his chus, that even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu had promised that he would protect him, and one would think that Yaakov wouldn't have any reason to be afraid, Shema Yigrom HaChet, maybe his behavior hadn't merited continued protection, maybe he had lost this promise, and that's why he was afraid. So some ask that seems to contradict an idea that we have in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos and Daf Nun Hey, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a positive promise, he doesn't go back on that. When he makes a negative prediction, so then the Jews can do tshuva, so then that can be revoked. But a positive promise is going to be permanent, can't be revoked, so why should Yaakov be afraid? Even if he hadn't continued to earn it, it should be something that was irrevocable. So some explain that this can be understood based on the language of the Rambam, that the Rambam understands that the reason that a positive nevuah can't be revoked is because we need to have a way to know if a Navi is real or not. We have to know if someone is actually a Navi Sheker or is giving correct prophecies. So how can we test if their nevuah is true or not? We have to see if it comes true. But maybe he'll give a nevuah of something negative that's going to happen, and it won't come true because the people did tshuva. So we can't test the Navi through negative nevuahs. So we can only test through positive nevuahs. So therefore, positive nevuahs have to be irrevocable. They can't be something that will change. But that's specifically when we're talking about a prophecy that's given to the people as a whole and it's transmitted to the community. But when it's just a communication directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the individual, as was the case here, so then it's not necessary to have such a policy. So it could be that perhaps there was the danger of this prophecy being revoked, and maybe that's why Yaakov was afraid. Okay, but he wasn't simply afraid. The Torah tells us Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayetzilo, that he was also very anguished in addition to being afraid. And Rashi says that he was afraid that he would get killed, and his anguish was that maybe he would kill others. So the Bali Atosis asks, regarding that concern, why should he be afraid of killing others? We have a halacha of Rodef, Habal Hargecha Hashkim Vahargo. If someone is coming to kill you, it's justifiable to kill him in response. So why did he need to be afraid that he might kill someone else? It would have been justifiable. So the truth is, it's a hard question to understand, because we understand why he would be concerned about this, that even if it would be justifiable, he doesn't want to have to kill anyone. A holy Jew is not going to want to have to be involved in killing anybody else, even if he had good reason to do so. There's the additional point that he may make the wrong call. In the fog of war, perhaps he would have a decision made that would involve taking someone's life and wouldn't be justifiable. So there's the concern as well. And the truth is, both of these answers are relevant and they inform each other that he wouldn't want to have to kill anyone, even if he would make the right call. And the concern that he might make the wrong call is even more scary to him. And both of them are understandable, that when a Jew goes to war, doesn't want to have to kill anyone. And he's also very concerned that he shouldn't make the wrong decision. And this is true even though the Maharal of Prague points out over here that the nature of this interaction with Esau's whole army constituted actual warfare, and therefore when one is engaged in warfare, there is greater latitude. It's not simply a din of Rodef, where one's only allowed to take action at the pursuer himself. One is able to engage the entire entity and group that is coming at him. There's greater latitude. But nonetheless, there's still the concern that both of these issues are relevant. And that's certainly what's on his mind. And it's something that is relevant not only to him, but to the entire Jewish people afterwards. And of course, at this moment, it's very reflective of the concern that Jewish soldiers have, that they understand that they have to take measures to protect themselves and their nation. But at the same time, they are very aware of the effect of having to kill someone, and certainly of the risk of killing someone unjustifiably. And the Bnei Yisrael, who bear Yaakov's name, are very devoted to balancing all these considerations, to making the preparations for war, but also doing whatever they can to not have to kill anyone unnecessarily, and certainly not mistakenly, and even when it's justifiable and it's not a mistake, recognizing that that's the last resort, and this is nothing any Jewish person would want to do. So we are also told here that he makes this tefillah as a part of his preparation, and the tefillah is expressed these poetic words, "Katonti mikol chasodim mikol emes asher asisa as avdecha," that I am too small for all of the blessings and all of the kindnesses that you have done for your servant. And this language is very powerful. He goes on to say, "Hatzileni na bi'adechi," please save me and rescue me, despite the fact that I am too small, and despite the fact that I may not earn it. And there is a comment that the Vilna Gaon has here regarding this, that the Gemara says in Sota that even though we understand that arrogance is a very dangerous quality, so much so the Rambam says one really has to stay completely far away from any kind of arrogance, and that this is one of the rare attributes that you're not supposed to have the golden mean, you're not supposed to have the middle path, but you should stay completely away from gaiva. Nonetheless, the Gemara says that Talmud Chacham should have a little bit. How much? An eighth of an eighth. An eighth of an eighth of gaiva, shminas of a shminas. So it's hard to know how exactly you measure that gaiva. And the Vilna Gaon suggested that the eighth of an eighth is a reference to the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha. The eighth parsha is Vayishlach, and the eighth pasuk is Katonti Mikol HaChasadim Mikol HaEmes. So that's also a little bit difficult to understand, because how does that represent Gaiva? This represents modesty. So here he's saying that I'm nothing, I'm too little for everything that you've done for me. So why would the Gemara call that Gaiva? Even a little bit of Gaiva, it seems to be an expression completely of modesty. And perhaps we could understand that what the Vilna Gaon is getting at is when the Gemara says that a Talmid Chacham needs to have a little bit of Gaiva, it's referring to the fact that if one sees himself as completely nothing, so then he's not going to feel any motivation to accomplish anything. If he doesn't think that he's anything at all, so then he's not going to get out of bed in the morning. In order to accomplish, you have to have at least a sense that there's something there that obligates you to move forward. So the question is, what's that machayev? What is that capacity that you recognize that is going to give you this movement, this desire for growth, and this motivation to become something? This little shmina shibishminas, this little bit of gaiva. So the Vilna Gaon says, where do you see that reflected? That here, Yaakov says, katonti mikol hachasadim, that I've received so much, I've been given so much blessing, and I'm not yet big enough for it. I have to fill those shoes. I have to feel that I have to earn all this. So that sense of a machayev, that sense that there's something that I've been given that I have to become worthy of, that's perhaps what the Gemara means, that a Talmid Chacham has to have at least that much a gaiva, at least that much of an awareness, that he has this tremendous potential and he has tremendous blessings, and he has to do what he can in order to earn it and to be worthy of it. So the language requires a little bit of definition. What's the difference between chasadim and emes? The Rishonim explain that the chesed is the promises in the first place, and the emes is the fact that they come true. And the Ramban comments they're not two separate terms. Emes is the fact that they last, that they go on. And so too, we recognize in the continuing struggle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us tremendous chasadim, and all of He has promised to protect us and do for us, and that the emes is reflected in the fact that this has continued to express itself throughout the generations, throughout all of the conflicts.